It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll hear your thoughts on a new elderly driving bill proposed in Wisconsin. It would require drivers age 75 and up to renew their licenses more frequently.
Now, we're continuing a new series called Teach Me What You Know. Each week, we bring in an expert on a different topic to, well, teach us what they know.
Last week, we spoke with a Wisconsin-based inventor and entrepreneur about how to start a business. This week, we'll learn how to meditate. Here with us to teach us how to meditate is Richard Davidson. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison, founder and chair of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds. He's also been involved in a recently published study that shows that meditation can actually change our gene expression. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
As a non-meditator, I have a notion of what's involved in meditation, but how do you define it? What is meditation?
Meditation is a family of mental training practices that can help us to promote well-being and to decrease suffering.
And that's the goal, decreasing suffering.
It is the goal, but really more than just decrease suffering, to actually promote well-being. Live our lives in the richest and most optimal ways possible.
And I know this is a lot of your research here, but why does that work? What is it about meditation that decreases suffering and makes for a better quality of life?
Well, meditation represents systematic ways of training the mind that can help us to cultivate resilience and to increase our sensitivity to others, to nourish qualities like kindness and compassion, all of which are important constituents of well-being.
I know there's a lot of different styles of meditation. We'll get into that a little bit. But is there something that binds them all together? Is there one common thing in the practice of meditation that's universal, more or less?
There are certain things that bind all the different forms of meditation together, and I would say that one thing that's common is training of attention, where we learn to have a more stable mind, which can produce increased equanimity, increased sensitivity to ourselves and to others.
Does it matter when we do it? Does it have to be first thing in the morning, late at night?
Most important thing is that we do it during periods of the day when we're awake.
All right. Sleeping doesn't count as meditation. Well, I want to get into some of the different kinds of meditation. It isn't just one thing, and it's not one size fits all, I gather.
Correct. There are many different types of meditation, and it's also the case that what works best for one person may not be best for another. And so it's important that people be exposed to a range of different kinds of practices and then choose for themselves what seems best.
Well, you're here in the studio now, and you're going to lead us through a couple of the different types. This will be my first meditation experience. I'm taking off my glasses. I guess that might be important. So you're going to talk us through what's the first kind we're going to do. And people listening along, you can do this, but any part that involves closing your eyes, if you're driving, don't do that part. So what are we doing first?
The first kind of meditation will be mindfulness meditation. And before we start, we say to ourselves and we cultivate the aspiration that these kinds of practices that we do, practices which can help us to calm our minds and open our hearts, are not just useful for ourselves, but they are actually useful for other human beings and other beings with whom we interact. And so when we first begin to practice, we reflect on this and cultivate the motivation that we are actually doing this not just for ourselves, but also to benefit other beings. And so with that motivation, we can simply sit in an upright posture wherever we may be sitting. It doesn't have to be in any particular posture. It could be in a chair or a couch, wherever one is sitting. But just the most important thing is to sit upright, and your eyes can be open or closed. It doesn't matter. Whatever you feel most comfortable, whatever is appropriate for the situation. And begin by simply attending to sensations in your head, in your forehead. Notice whatever sensations may be there. If they're pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, just notice whatever may be present and pay attention to the sensations. And if the muscle sensations begin to relax, simply notice them relaxing and sweep your attention through your body in this way. So moving from your forehead, go down into your face. We often store a lot of tension in our jaw. Bring your attention to the jaw and simply notice whatever sensations might be there. And then sweeping our attention further down our body into our neck and our shoulders, our arms, attending to whatever might be present, noticing whatever sensations, feelings arise as we do this. And then sweeping our attention through our torso into our sit bones, noticing the feelings of our sitting in the chair that we're sitting in or whatever we're sitting on. And then bringing our attention into our legs, our feet, and our entire body, noticing whatever arises, being in the present moment. And if our attention begins to wander, we can simply bring our attention back to our bodies and to the present moment. This is a form of meditation that is a kind of mindfulness meditation. It can be done anywhere at any time. And often it helps to start with very short periods of practice that can be sprinkled throughout the day.
That's Richard Davidson. He is teaching us how to meditate. I hear a lot about the benefits of mindfulness. Can you talk about those briefly before we try another kind of meditation?
Mindfulness can help us decrease our mind wandering. It can help us be present with other people as we interact with them. It can help us to be less distracted. And it can also help to cultivate a kind of equanimity where we're not jangled and hijacked by unexpected events, which we can't prevent, but those events that occur on a daily basis.
The other kind you're going to teach us today is loving kindness and compassion practice. Is that right?
That's right. And this is a very simple form of meditation. And we can begin this in the same way, sitting in an upright posture. And again, very briefly reflecting on the motivation for engaging in this kind of practice. And we have a short period of time here, but we can begin by bringing into our mind a loved one. Reflecting on this person. It could be a close family member. It could be a very dear friend. And envision a time in this person's life when they may have been suffering. And cultivate the strong aspiration that they be relieved from that suffering. And to help us do that, we can silently repeat one or two phrases to ourselves as we visualize them. We can repeat the phrase, "May you enjoy happiness and its causes," and "May you be free of suffering and its causes." May you enjoy happiness and its causes. May you be free of suffering and its causes. And we do that visualizing the loved one in as strong a way as we can. And then we can do the same thing for other people. And we can eventually move on to even people that we consider to be difficult people, people that may sort of push our buttons a little bit. And we can honestly bring them into our minds and hearts and cultivate the aspiration that they be relieved of whatever suffering they may experience. And one of the things that scientific research has found is that when people do this on a regular basis, it actually changes their brains and their behavior, it increases the likelihood that they behave in a more what we call pro-social and empathic and altruistic way.
Just briefly, I guess I've always thought of meditation as being really inwardly directed, but you've presented both of these as something focused on benefiting others.
Actually, the primary intent is really other-focused. It's not self-focused. There's so much self-focus in our culture, me, me, me. This is really about focusing on others, because research has found that the most important way for us to cultivate well-being and happiness is to be kind to others.
Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Richard Davidson. He's been leading us in some meditation in our weekly segment, Teach Us What You Know. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry at UW-Madison. He's founder and chair of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds.
A new bill proposed in Wisconsin would require older drivers to get their licenses renewed more often. Senator Fred Risser is a sponsor of the bill. He's a Democratic state senator from Madison. Senator Risser, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
So what exactly would your bill require?
Well, many states require that older drivers have extra tests or extra qualifications. The bill we've introduced would say that those drivers 75 and older would have to apply for a license every 4 years rather than every 8 years. And secondly, it would require that at every four-year application, they would have to have their eyes checked. The bill does not require a new road test, does not require a physical test, as some states do. It's an effort to make our highways safer for all of us that drive, and it's also an effort to alert older people that they should start thinking about their capabilities of driving.
Why do you think the bill is needed?
Well, as I say, the bill is needed because insurance statistics prove that most accidents are caused by either the very young or the very old. And unfortunately, those older people involved in accidents are involved in more fatal accidents. It's a way of trying to make the highways safer for all of us. As I say, most states in the union do require extraordinary efforts to qualify older people to drive. Many states require physicals. I'm not going that far.
What would you say to some who might look at this and think that this is age discrimination?
Well, you know, I don't think it's age discrimination at all. I think that some people are qualified to drive up until they're 100 years old. Others people are never qualified to drive. Age is not the significant thing. But the statistics show that the older people are, as a group, more apt to get involved in accidents. They're more apt to be inattentive drivers. They're apt to have more problems with their eyes, and the highways we want to make as safe as possible. I don't think it's age discrimination at all. I think it's a helpful thing for all of us.
Are you optimistic that your bill will pass in the state legislature?
Well, I've gotten some co-sponsorship from both sides of the aisle, and in talking to the Motor Vehicle Department, they seem very supportive of the idea. It's a way of trying to make our highways safer. And it doesn't discriminate against anyone, because a person who's older and able to drive can continue to drive as long as they're able to do so.
Well, Senator, thanks for joining us for a few minutes.
Thank you for having me.
That was Senator Fred Risser, Democratic State Senator from Madison.
Now we'll learn how driving becomes different as we age, and we'll learn how to start a conversation with an older loved one about their driving. We want to hear from you on this. Do you think older people should have to renew their driver's licenses more often? Why or why not? Have you dealt with this issue in your family, or maybe dealt with yourself, or you're about to have this conversation over the holidays? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@wpr.org.
Sue Sweeney joins us now. She's the head of the Department of Gerontology at Medina University in Michigan. Sue, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How does driving change as we age?
Well, we change and some of our abilities change, but I really want to make the point that aging is so individualized that it's hard to make generalizations about it, and it really needs to be assessed on an individual basis, because the process of aging can be much more rapid in one person and slower in another, and even organ systems within one person age at different rates, so that it is important to assess each situation individually. And also I want to make the point that driving isn't an all-or-nothing sort of thing. As we age, we tend to have difficulties with some different aspects of driving. vision impairments can pose a problem. Sometimes arthritis in the neck makes it difficult for us to turn our heads and really check that blind spot. We may have difficulties with sensation or coordination of our feet, so that we might have difficulty pressing on the accelerator or the brake. And then cognitive impairment really comes into play as people maybe are in early stages of dementia and don't have the judgment that they need, or don't have the ability to find their way as readily. So all of those things can become complications as we age in the process of driving.
Let's talk about, you mentioned that this is an individualized nature and we shouldn't generalize on the elderly. First, let's talk about how we can do sort of a self-assessment. When do we start to know that maybe we shouldn't be driving alone?
I think that people sort of start to know. It's a question whether they want to admit it to themselves sometimes, but if you find yourself confused about where you are, or you're having some near misses, you know, you didn't judge a distance correctly, or left turns in particular seem to have pose a challenge for older adults. And so, you know, maybe you realize you didn't judge that the speed of the oncoming car well enough, and it was a near miss. You know, if you find yourself scraping the side of the car coming out of the driveway, or going up on the curb when you're making a turn, even though you're turning at a proper speed, all of those things would be indicators. Or if you find yourself getting really nervous driving on the expressway because you know, there are so many sensory inputs, there's so many judgments you have to make, and the speeds are high. All of those things, I think, are cues that a person might pay attention to and begin to make some changes. And I think, you know, as I said, driving isn't all or nothing. Many older adults begin to self-regulate their driving as they notice some of these changes. So they, if they see that they don't see as well at night and they have a lot of difficulty with glare from the headlights, they might decide, well, you know, I'm not driving at night anymore. Or if they get on the expressway and it just seems overwhelming and they get very nervous, they might say, well, I'm just taking surface streets now. Talking to a family friend recently, she said she doesn't do left turns anymore. She looks at a map and she figures out how she can make three right turns and, you know, go where she wants to go, but without putting herself at risk of those judgments that are required in making a left turn.
Hmm. What can, is there anything that someone can do maybe to keep their skills sharp? Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a program through the American Association of Retired Persons. They have a safe driving program that's now offered both face-to-face and online that can kind of sharpen some of your skills. There are programs that do driver evaluation and driver rehabilitation, and they can help people figure out what they need to compensate, how they need to compensate for some of these problems with driving. There's a program called CarFit, which is a national program, and they'll actually go to communities. They train volunteers, and they go to communities, and a mature driver will come with their car, and they'll evaluate for safety, all kinds of things, like are they seeing well over the steering wheel? Do they have enough room between their chest and the airbag and the steering wheel so as not to deploy it and have an injury? They look at head restraint alignment. They look at how easily they can access the brake and the gas pedal. But they also have some videos online that could help an individual or family members do their own kind of evaluation for this kind of thing. And that's www.car-fit.org. And that's a great thing. They also point out that you can get adaptive devices for your vehicle. So if you've got the problem with turning your neck, you can get larger panoramic mirrors to put on your car. If you're having problems with the pedals, you can sometimes find pedal extenders will benefit you. Leverage handles to help with opening doors. Ways to adjust the seat so that it's more comfortable if you have arthritis in your spine, for example. So I think there's a lot of things that people can do before they have to give up those car keys.
We're talking with Sue Sweeney about the challenges older drivers face. She's the head of the Department of Gerontology at Medina University in Michigan.
And we want to hear from you. Are we talking about you or your family? Are you an older driver who gave up? Or is this an issue in your family that you're still trying to resolve? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. We're continuing our conversation about older drivers and a proposal in Wisconsin to require more frequent testing of drivers 75 years old and older. Our guest is Sue Sweeney, the head of the Department of Gerontology at Medina University in Michigan.
We're taking your calls now. Are you an older driver? How does age affect your driving, or does it at all? Do you think it's a good idea to require older drivers to renew their licenses more often? Why or why not? Have you had to have this conversation with a relative about whether it's time to put away the car keys? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
Let's go right to the phones, and Richard in Oconomowoc is waiting for us. Hi, Richard.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, what's your question or comment?
Oh, my comment about your vision requirements are so true and so sincere. Back in 1981, my eye doctor had diagnosed me, and he says, boy, oh boy, you're lucky if you can ever drive a car. Now, that's back in 81, and I still drive, and I still manage to renew my driver's license, but I did it all by my intellect and passing their tests. Because I really, really want to work, but I did it all by Braille.
You did it by Braille?
I did it by Braille, just out of memory rather than vision requirement.
And so, Sue Sweeney, what do you think of that? Would requiring more frequent testing actually solve the problem, or will we see people who, you know, they just don't want to give up the keys and they'll find ways around the system?
Well, it's hard. I suppose you can drive without a valid license, but if the law passes and, you know, you have to appear in person and take the test, I think that's the way it'll be. I don't really think the law is particularly objectionable. Starting around 75, people begin to see more changes, more physical changes that could impede their ability to drive well. So while I'm staying behind my statement that the ability to drive is very individualized, you know, starting around 75, the prevalence of those kinds of problems do begin to appear. And as long as it's an individual assessment, I don't really have a problem with it.
Let's go next to Debbie in Manitowoc. Hi, Debbie.
Hello. I think it would be, it is individual, but I think it would be good to have some system of testing. You know, my father became gradually frail over time, and it wasn't to the point where we had to take the license away or call him in. But, you know, eventually he got pulled over by the sheriff's department, and they ordered him to take a driving test. He's very frail now, so, you know, he's not going to do that. He's not going to get his license back. But, you know, I wish there would be been a more formal system in place. He wasn't really a danger to anybody because he didn't drive very much, and he seemed to be okay until the very end. And, you know, my mother is legally blind. She's totally blind, so she doesn't drive. So it makes an impact on the family because they live in a semi-rural area. I'm ending up doing a lot of the driving for them because there's just not a lot of public transportation out there. You know, there's the senior cabs and so on, but people are a little not very well informed about that, and, you know, there's sometimes people are a little intimidated by it. So, yeah, it does affect your whole family, and it's definitely something to keep in mind as you get older yourself or as, you know, your family members get older.
Thanks for that call, Debbie. I wanted to ask you, Sue, if we start to suspect that a loved one might not be in the best health or cognitive ability to drive, how do we open up that conversation? Because, you know, many people see driving as a form of freedom.
Absolutely. Well, I really highly recommend that families start talking about driving before it becomes a critical problem, so that you've got the topic on the table. And some of the ways you can start those conversations is like if there's an accident in the news with an older driver, just say, you know, well, I noticed that in the news today, and I'm wondering how you're feeling about your driving. Do you feel like, you know, are you noticing that you get any confused or that you're struggling with left turns or that kind of thing? Or you could talk about, you know, how has the family dealt with that in the past, like with your folks? How did you handle the driving issue with them? And, you know, hear their experience as the younger family member having to deal with the older family member, and that can get the conversation going. I just think it's really important to approach it in an empathic way and a concerned way. You know, I think starting out by saying I'm concerned about if you have observed a problem, rather than saying, you know, I think you ought to.
Mm-hmm.
I think as we age, we like to keep a sense of autonomy and control of our lives. And so when an adult child confronts us with something, it tends to get us defensive. But if it's expressed in terms of, you know, I understand this is tough to do, or I understand that driving means so much to you, the person is a little less defensive about it. And I think it's really useful to find out what does driving mean to the individual, because it can mean a lot of different things. As you suggested, it means freedom to many people. To some folks, it's an important part of their identity, being a driver. For some folks, being able to get out and go for a drive is a refuge. It's a way to, you know, escape from the stresses of life and just kind of enjoy the scenery. For other people, it's having a sense of control. You know, I know my husband doesn't like anybody else to drive. He likes to be the one in charge. So if we understand what it means to the person, it helps us to be more empathic with them around facing the eventuality of giving up this freedom, this ability that they've had.
Let's take one last call from Becky in Verona. Hi, Becky.
Hi. My dad has Alzheimer's and my mom doesn't drive, but she knew that it was time for him to not be behind the wheel anymore. So before anything was done, she found local area businesses that would drive them places, pick them up and take them to the grocery store, pick them up and take them to the doctor. She got all of that taken care of, and then she called all of us kids, or six of us, all over the country. And we all came to her house for dinner, and we all sat there while she told my dad that he shouldn't be driving anymore. So I think it's really important to be prepared and to have people there to back you up, so my mom wouldn't have to do that by herself. And we just told our dad that we cared about him, and we'd hate to see either he be in an accident or be in an accident that would cause harm to someone else. We wouldn't be able to live with ourselves. And honestly, I think he was relieved, because I think he really knew something wasn't right. And it wasn't nearly as bad as we thought it was going to be.
Did it help that it sounds like you had a system already, a plan in place for him, so that he didn't have to necessarily feel alone?
Exactly. And then, like I said, my mom already found places that would provide transportation for them. So, you know, that was a comfort that he didn't have to worry about how are we going to get places. And you just really have to take the time to plan something like that and be supportive.
Well, thank you, Becky, for calling and telling us about that. Sue, what do you think about the way Becky's family handled that situation?
I think her mom's a really wise woman. It's very important to identify alternatives and to really discuss with the individual affected, you know, how they're going to maintain their lives without the ability to drive. So I think she did exactly the right thing. I'm very impressed.
Well, Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
It was Sue Sweeney. She's head of the Department of Gerontology at Medina University in Michigan.
Switzerland is considering a guaranteed minimum income for its citizens, meaning that everyone would get a set amount of money from the government and then they can go off and earn more or not on their own.
Our next guest says there's a case to be made for adopting that plan in the United States with some modifications, a libertarian case, in fact. Matthew Feeney joins us now. He's an assistant editor at Reason.com and Reason 24/7 News, and he's written about this issue. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You think that there could be a good trade-off here, bring in a guaranteed national income and get rid of a lot of government assistance programs. Why would that be a good trade?
Well, I think that the system that we have at the moment is not just inefficient, but actually rather, immoral in the way that it treats people. And I wrote about the Swiss referendum that's going to be happening mostly because I think that something similar in the U.S. wouldn't be that bad an idea. However, I do think that in order for such a system to work, that, you know, it would have to replace all of existing income and a lot of corporate welfare. I just don't think it's fiscally feasible without, you know, huge welfare reforms. But I don't think there's anything wrong in principle with just saying, look, every year you get X amount and take care of yourself or, you know, help each other.
So what kind of amounts are we talking about for a guaranteed minimum income?
Well, so the there's been a bit of discussion about this. The Swiss amount, I mean, the figure that has been talked about is that every Swiss adult would get $2,800 US, the equivalent of every month. I do think that figure is quite high. The libertarian author Charles Murray wrote a paper and actually wrote a full book on this issue where he made the proposal of $10,000, and that was back in a few years ago. So you could have the amount now at something like the poverty line, which is about $11,500.
And this money would come from the government?
Yeah, I think it would come from the same source it comes from now, taxation mostly.
So help me understand how that's a libertarian perspective.
Yeah, this is, as you might be able to imagine, a bit of pushback I get from this from my fellow libertarians is this is just, still big government. And I think it's important to point out that, people like Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, Thomas Paine, as well as, as I mentioned earlier, Charles Murray have advocated for something like a guaranteed income. It's not necessarily contrary to libertarianism. In fact, I think that it is quite compatible with libertarianism. If you remember that something that libertarians like to talk about is personal responsibility and people knowing what to do best with their own money. There are certainly people out there who think of this as some sort of incompatibility, but I'm not one of them.
So this is money handed without conditions in your mind?
Yes. Yeah, it would be, I think that it would have to be without conditions or else you would have a huge political problem. And you would still have people, sillily saying that, oh, these are, just poor people mooching with the state, which, isn't a very nice way to talk about it. So I think if it was just a guaranteed income for every adult, regardless of income, then it would be a lot easier. But like I said, this would have to be done on condition of, the abolition of a lot of the welfare system we have in place. And I think it would also have to be conditional on some sort of legislative barrier to any, welfare systems being put in place in the future. Mm. Charles Murray, when he wrote his book about this, said that there would have to be something like a constitutional amendment in order to make sure that didn't happen again.
Mm. If we provide a minimum income, do we still then provide public funding for education, housing, health services, and other things like that?
No, I mean, I think the only way that this could possibly be funded is if you got rid of things like that and leave education, health, housing, and everything to private individuals and private organizations.
So you say that this would get rid of the humiliation of the current system. What kind of humiliation are you talking about?
Well, I find it really, I don't like the fact that a lot of people who are on welfare have to pass drug tests in order to receive their benefits. I also don't like, I mean, as the acronym might betray, I'm, you know, not originally from America, but I, you know, the whole system of food stamps where people are given, you know, sort of fake money in effect and told that they can only buy government sanctioned goods. I just think it would be a much more humane thing to give people money and say you can buy what you want, eat what you want, and do whatever drugs you want, but it's your life and you have to take personal responsibility. I think that the system I'm proposing would actually empower people, you know, the most in need more than the current system.
Is there a motivation behind this idea in the way of ending poverty? And do you think that poverty would still be an issue under a system like this?
So there's always going to be relative poverty. I don't think we're going to get rid of that. But I can't help think that if you got rid of a lot of the administrative barriers and you got rid of a lot of the systems currently in place, that it would be better off in the long run for the people that, you know, welfare is aimed at helping. Unfortunately, you know, I think it's important to point out that we actually do have the sort of cash in place. The Census Bureau estimated that the amount of total welfare spending at the moment is four times the amount that it would take to lift all Americans living in poverty above the poverty line. You know, I don't think this is because of a lack of wealth. It's an administrative problem. And that's why I think, you know, giving it directly to people is preferable.
Would providing a guaranteed income be an incentive, though, against finding employment, for example?
It's possible. I think, you know, there will be a small minority of people who decide that they would rather live on $11,500 a year than try to find work if they could get it. But, you know, that said, I think without with the guaranteed minimum income being the only source of welfare, there would be, you know, a huge amount of I feel like, you know, social pressure that would arise for people to work because people would know that you had a guaranteed income anyway under the system. So the question would be either why aren't you working when there are jobs available, or you would have a legitimate, you know, grievance, which would be you live in an economically depraved area. But that's already the situation under the current system.
Well, we're wondering if you, dear listener, have any questions or thoughts on this issue. The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What do you think of providing a national minimum income in lieu of government funding for other resources that we might be already used to under the current system? And Matthew, I also wanted to ask about, I was reading about the Swiss proposal, and one commentator said that providing a national minimum income would allow people to choose employment based on the work they want to do, not the work that they have to do in order to get by. Do you agree with that? And what sectors do you think might lose employees as on account of a system like this?
That's an interesting point. I actually hadn't read it before. I don't want to jump to any conclusions about what the situation would be in Switzerland. I suppose that, you know, under this current system, people who like their jobs would keep it. People who don't like their jobs, I think, would still have a slight incentive to keep their job because, you know, like I'm saying, the basic national income under the system I'm proposing would still be for, you know, the vast majority of working Americans would be a pay cut. You know, it's basic. It's not going to be something that most Americans could quit a job and still maintain their lifestyle with.
Let's take a call from Carl in Darlington. Is on the line. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
What's Hi. Your question?
My question was, has anybody really looked into the economic impact it would make allowing people to take a risk in starting a new business or innovate, having a security that wasn't welfare, that was guaranteed, allowing you to better yourself and boost the economy?
What do you think of that, Matthew?
I mean, if I heard correctly, it was a question about the how exactly this would be funded, or has anyone done research on that? Sorry, I couldn't quite hear.
He was wondering about allocating some of those funds into a social safety net.
Sure. Well, I mean, the whole point of the system is that, you know, you get rid of a government safety net, but if, you know, wealthy people with their guaranteed minimum income checked once a year decide that, you know, they would rather send that money to private charities to set up, you know, a neighborhood or citywide or statewide charities that would provide, you know, a safety net for people who need more than the basic income. I mean, I certainly don't have anything against that idea at all.
Andy was saying this could free up people to take risks of starting a new business. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that's certainly true. I mean, part of the proposal that I'm making is that it would be cash, and you know, I fully accept that under the system, some people are going to make bad decisions. You know, if you abolish the welfare state, and then someone who had hard luck decides to invest half of their yearly check into, you know, a company that goes bust, or someone irresponsible decides to fly to Vegas and put it all on black. I mean, that is regrettable, but that's something that, you know, I don't think governments are very good at making policies against stupidity. I just think, you know, we should trust each other to help people in need and not rely on huge government welfare spending. And I think, you know, under this system, if someone does decide to do something responsible, there would be societal impact and, you know, a certain level of stigma attached.
You're worried that the Switzerland proposal is going to go the wrong way. What are your concerns with it?
Well, I think I should preface this by saying that I don't actually think that it's going to pass. The Swiss rejected a referendum capping executive pay to 12 times the amount of their lowest employee. So it seems like the Swiss are certainly not in the mood for radical economic reform. That said, I do think my worry about this is I just think that the amount is far too high and generous for a country that is already, let's be honest, you know, quite well off. And I also am concerned that it's not going to come with the drastic, you know, welfare and government spending reforms that I'm proposing. I think, you know, the Swiss could potentially have a big, you know, government spending problem if this is implemented without, you know, very, very careful reforms attached.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me.
That was Matthew Feeney with Reason.com. We have a link to his piece, Scrap the Welfare State and Give People Free Money, on the Central Time Facebook page.
And while you're there checking out the story, let us know what you think of the idea. You can comment on the Facebook page.